stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Glad you're with us on this Tuesday afternoon. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you're new to the show, what we do, and we've been doing it now for some 11 years, is answer questions from non-Catholics. Those of you who would like to know, well, why does the Catholic Church teach this, but they do not teach this over here? We can answer questions of all sorts. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. Also, you can text the letters EWTN to 58177. When you do that, you'll get a really quick robo response from us. Once you receive that, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email to ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. All right, and the A-team is here, ready to roll for you. Our producer, Pedro Quiles, Matt Kabinski, handling the phone situation, Rich Jesse on social media. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question, if you would, please, in the chat screen. Rich will see that. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio, and we're off to the races. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you getting along?
Very well. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing decent, thank you.
You know, as I mentioned a moment ago, we've been doing this show for some 11 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Just when you thought you'd heard all the different questions there are, somebody else pops up with a brand new question.
Okay, let's hear it.
I absolutely love it. This is from Catherine. She sent this to us yesterday via YouTube. Couldn't get to it then, so we're going to get to it right now. Catherine says, I had a priest step out of the confessional and say, I'm too busy. Everyone is only allowed to say one sin. This doesn't seem legitimate. Should I report this to the bishop?
So, Tom actually previewed me on this question before we got on the air, and I have already blown my top, right? And
yes.
So my brains are leaking out on the floor right now. You know,
and I said to you, "All right, David, save it for the show," because you know I knew you were going to say something wild. So, what do you got for us?
First of all, I'm incensed. That is a completely incoherent thing for any priest to do if he knows anything about the theology of the confessional. Because the doctrine of the church is, if you are conscious of more than one mortal sin, and you only confess one, you are absolved for neither.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a completely arbitrary and very foolish restriction for some priest to invent on his own authority, which he cannot do. Like, he has no authority to do this. And in fact, if he could, it would invalidate the entire confession for anybody that had more than one sin. It's absurd. Now, here are some alternatives that he could have done.
All right.
He could have popped his head out of the confessional and said, folks, you know, we got a lot of people in line. You know, Mass is coming up in half an hour or whatever it is. This can't be a counseling session. So just, you know, think of your sins, enumerate them in kind and number. I'm going to absolve you, and we'll move on. We'll try to move this thing quickly so everybody can get through. That would have been a perfectly reasonable thing to say.
Sure.
And there is the phenomenon of the person who goes to the confessional, and they pour out their entire life story, right? And Father Thomas Dubay, who I just thought the world of, he was a great guy. I'm sorry we lost him. He would say, look, just come in, say your darn sins, say you're sorry, and move on. Like, you don't have to give the life story. Now, some people don't have an opportunity to get pastoral counseling, and so the confessional sometimes kind of morphs into that. But that's really not what it's intended for. I mean, it can do that, like, if you have time and space and so forth. But in a rush, say your sins, say you're sorry, move on. And the Council of Trent said, kind and number. Yeah. You don't have to give the life story. You just go, okay, murder twice, adultery three times, you know, theft four times, bearing false witness eight times. I'm sorry. Done. whoo, out of there. It doesn't have to take a long time, right? So he could have, how about teaching the people how to make a concise, efficient, and valid confession? You could do that. You could do that, right? Yeah. Or this is another alternative. He could also stick his head out the door and say, look, folks, I've got exactly half an hour. I will get to as many of you as I can get to in a half hour. When the clock strikes noon, I'm out of here. If you're at the end of the line, I'm sorry. Come back tomorrow, or we'll make other arrangements or call the office or whatever. I've seen priests do that. One time I was in confession. This years and years and years ago. It was 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And Priest A was in the confessional. Priest B was getting ready to say Mass. And Priest A was determined that he was going to get out of the confessional before Mass started. All right?
Yeah.
So he starts saying, he's hearing confessions. Also, the Mass starts. And the priest hops out the confessional, and there's this line of very sorrowful-looking penitents, right? And they had the, you know, the crushed puppy look on their face. And he was like, okay, 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 follow me, follow me, follow me. And we all go down in the church basement, and he finishes hearing confessions down there.
So
there's a lot of different ways you could do this, other than to lay down a criterion, a rule for which he has no authority, that would, in fact, invalidate most people's confessions.
Yeah. So Catherine's final question here, should I report this to the bishop?
I would.
Would you?
Or it depends on the diocese, right? I mean, first of all, is the guy the pastor of the parish? If he's the parochial vicar, then you tell the pastor.
Okay.
If he's the pastor, your diocese may have a vicar for clergy.
Uh-huh.
That's another person who would handle this at that level.
Yeah.
But you know, it would not be inappropriate to tell the bishop. Now, what should your expectations be of the bishop?
Uh-huh.
I can guarantee you that if you call the diocese and tell the secretary will know. Beyond that, you're going to have to wash your hands of it and hope that the wheels of justice churn the right way. And you just, it's out of your hands. You've kicked it up the chain of command, and you just, whatever happens will happen.
I understand. Catherine, thanks so much for your question via YouTube. Hopefully you were able to hear that today. Couldn't get to it yesterday, but if nothing else, you certainly made us smile. We'll leave it at that. And if you would... David is shaking over here. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. And as we're doing the show and you're listening to us on YouTube, you can send us an email or send us a question by putting it in the chat screen. In a moment, we'll talk with Rick in Minnesota, also Randy in Bryan, Ohio. A couple lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Our phone number 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Rich Jesse handling social media for us today, so he will also see your texts. If you want to text the letters EWTN to 58177, he will shoot that into the studio for us. Meanwhile, before we get to the phones here, are you familiar with the Holy Archangels? Well, we're talking about St. Michael the Archangel, Gabriel, Raphael. They are the Holy Archangels. You can celebrate these mighty messengers of God. Ask for their intercession with a free EWTN ebook. It's absolutely free. Visit EWTN.com/Holy Archangels for this free EWTN ebook. EWTN.com/Holy Archangels. How about that? If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Rick in Minnesota, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today, sir?
I had a question regarding, I hate to use the word censorship, but in regard to Nihil Obstas and Imprimaturs, is there any regulatory thing of similar substance regarding Catholic media?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Not that I know of, apart from the media that is a book. And the reason is that, I mean, the Nihil Obstat says that there's nothing in the text that is contrary to Catholic doctrine and in the judgment of a censor. and the imprimatur is the bishop's permission that the thing be printed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I suppose you could get, in theory, you could have a bishop sort of, grant his imprimatur, as it were, in advance to a media organization. But I don't see how you could possibly grant a Nikolaustadt, because, I could be Orthodox for 35 minutes of this show and then veer off into heresy in the third quarter, right? and you couldn't pre-guarantee that Andrus is not going to lose his mind three quarters into the show, right? It's always in retrospect, looking back on it. Now, you could circulate that. You could make a transcript of it or a recording or something and circulate that after the fact and maybe obtain a Nikolaustadt. But the practice is generally applied only to texts.
Is that helpful for you, Rick?
Yeah, very much so. Thank you very much.
You are most welcome. And if I could take on just a moment here to put in a little plug for our own theology department.
Yeah.
We are very, very diligent in vetting everything. Now, a live show like what we're doing right now, there's no way. However,
it would be the last show I ever did.
Well, that's true. There's always retrospect.
Unless it was, material heresy is a little different, right? So this formal heresy is when you absolutely come out and you obstinately deny a dogma of the church that you know to be a dogma of the church. Material heresy is when you say something contrary to church dogma, but you don't realize that you're doing it.
Yeah.
And I remember I had a conversation one time with a fellow, and I'm not going to say who he was, but he represented a Catholic apostolate. And we had kind of a tete-a-tete on a theological issue, and we had an argument, and he had a bunch of priests he was arguing with. And then at the end of the day, he came back and said, well, we've concluded we were all material heretics, meaning, we got this wrong, but we didn't know we were getting it wrong. And we're not above making mistakes here. I get corrections all the time from people on air and off.
Sure.
And I was doing a live show once with Catholic Answers, and I made a statement about something being a heresy. And then, you got this live chat going with the Catholic Answers people, and I got a note back from the producer saying, Jimmy says that's not a heresy, it's an error, and there's a distinction. You made a mistake there.
Wow.
So I was getting real-time correction from Jimmy Akin during the show.
Pretty awesome.
That was pretty cool. Yeah, exactly. And I welcome that. Like, if I ever make a mistake, unwittingly, of course, please tell me, and we'll fix it.
Oh, absolutely. And we all go to great pains to make sure that everything that goes over the radio, the website, television, the Register, news agency, everything else, our news division, we want to stand with the church.
Absolutely,
in each and every way.
That's why we have the Catechism and the Bible sitting here on the desk right now. And that's more than just for show. Tom will tell you, I'm pulling that sucker out during the show all the time.
You bet. There you go. And that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Andrus, maybe you'd like to say, here's why I'm not interested in becoming a Catholic. Love to chat with you. 833-288-EWTN. 3986. Call to communion on this Tuesday afternoon on EWTN. Let's go now to Randy in Ohio. Randy is listening to us on the Great Annunciation Radio. Hello, Randy. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, Tom. Hello, Dr. Andrus.
Hi.
Howdy.
Love you guys. Catholic. Went through the annulment. I got the letter back from the diocese saying that, in a nutshell, congratulations, communion, confession, can date, I can get married. And we went through the annulment to get married, but my priest now didn't really want to let me go to confession, but he let me do one, but he will not give us communion.
Okay, thank you. So let me ask you a question. You said us. I'm not sure who the us is in this picture. You talked about that you received an annulment, but who's us?
Both of us did. My fiance.
Okay, you got a fiance. So you guys are going to get married. Okay, so what reason did the priest give for denying you communion or denying you confession?
I think it's because we live together.
Okay, yeah, that would pose a difficulty. If the priest believes that you're engaged in conjugal living and activity that is to be restricted to within the bounds of holy matrimony, then that would be problematic, right? So you would have to amend your life in accord with church teaching before he would admit. So, I mean, like, there are a lot of things that can bar you from confession and communion other than an invalid marriage. I mean, you know, for example, if I, you know, God forbid, if I went out and became an abortionist, you know, for example, and I'm doing something that is just grossly in violation of church teaching, and I present myself for communion, priest is going to say, no, sorry, Anders, you're in obstinate public denial of the teaching of the church and doing something grossly immoral. I'm not going to admit you to communion. Similarly, if I went to confession and said, well, you know, I'm sorry for kicking my dog, and he says, well, what about this business about being an abortionist? Oh, I'm not sorry for that. Well, no, I'm sorry. Hey, I'm not gonna absolve you then. You got to come totally clean, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, I'm not going to get into the details. I mean, it's really between you and your priest what's going on in your intimate life with your fiance, but that would, yeah, that's an issue. So make sure that he's in the know about you and you're in the know about his concerns and regulate your life according with the church teaching, and then you got no problem coming back.
Randy, is that helpful for you?
Yes, one more thing, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
We've discussed with him since we started the annulment plan, process, and it's been done now for almost a year, but when we started it, we made a commitment to each other. We have separate bedrooms. We're living as brother and sister. I mean, that's the only way I can put
okay.
it.
Okay, all right. And the priest knows this.
And we've told the father that, and I don't know if he... I know it's probably easy to say, but, I mean, he is a young priest, too. We are his first parish he's had.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes a difference.
So all right, all right. This is a judgment call on the part of the priest, okay? That's what this boils down to. It's a judgment call on the part of the priest. I know priests, very Orthodox priests, very conservative priests, very morally, like, even, like, sort of hard-nosed priests, right? Who, in a situation like this, would admit a couple to communion if they promised that they were living chaste lives, right? And because sometimes, like when people are cohabitating, it's not economically feasible for them to move out. Maybe they have no place to go and they can't afford two rents, right, given their current circumstances. And priests understand this generally, and they'd say, okay, as long as you guys promise, you know, you're not up to anything, I'll readmit you to the sacraments. Now, I could imagine a priest, I'm not saying this is what he should or shouldn't do, but I could imagine a priest saying, okay, the appearance of scandal remains, right? Even if your behavior is in line, you know, you're giving the appearance of conjugal living, therefore if I admit you to communion, maybe it'll scandalize the faithful or something to that effect. I don't know what's in his head. But there's no law on it from the church here that would force his hand to deny you communion, provided that you are not in fact engaged in sexual activity. There's nothing that would absolutely bar him giving you communion, except that he has some pastoral judgment here, and what that is, I don't know.
Randy, thanks so much for your call from Ohio. Appreciate that. Call to communion here on EWTN. Still plenty of time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Stephen's watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Stephen says, I was discussing with a friend the Pope's recent comments about the death penalty. I agreed with the Pope, but my friend did not. What is the Church's teaching on the death penalty, and are Catholics bound to agree?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So anybody who has studied this issue knows that that there is a noticeable shift in the language the Church uses with respect to the death penalty. So, I mean, up until the 1960s, the death penalty was actually on the books in the Vatican City State. And, I mean, not many people were executed, not for a long time, but, I mean, you could be executed in the Pope's own jurisdiction by a civil magistrate appointed by the Pope, right? And, I mean, within the 20th century, there was a Vatican-appointed executioner who had the job of, you know, putting people to death.
Wow.
On church property, you know, like appointed by the Pope. And the fellow who did it, I mean, he was I've read the story of the last Vatican executioner. He was a pious soul. He got up, went to daily communion, you know, went to confession, then went about his, you know, I hate to say whistled while he worked and went to his job and, you know, pulled the lever, right?
Aye,
that's a fact of church history.
Okay.
And you know, dogmatically, I mean, there have been occasions, particularly in the Middle Ages, when there were religious sects that dissented from the church's teaching on the death penalty, and they were actually required to acknowledge the legitimacy of the death penalty as a condition for coming back into communion with the Catholic Church. Mm. Right? And and Pius XII, actually, I think, was one of the last popes to actually discourse quite eloquently about the death penalty and its relationship to justice, and the reality of retributive justice being one of the motives for having a judicial system and so on and so forth, all of which would warrant or justify the death penalty under certain circumstances. Now, the change comes in with John Paul II when he publishes his encyclical on the Gospel of Life, Evangelium Vitae. And what John Paul II put forth is the idea that, well, the death penalty might not be intrinsically immoral, but it is, in the modern context, grossly imprudent. I mean, this is his opinion, right? This is his theological opinion.
Yeah.
Because there are other means to accomplish the ends of both restorative and retributive justice that are seemingly more effective and spare us, some of the problems with the death penalty. And the whole thing seems to be more in accord with the concept of human dignity. So let's work towards the elimination of the death penalty. That was sort of John Paul's point of view. And that enters into the catechism and to church teaching. And the question, do Catholics have to give theological assent to that proposition, was raised by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith when Ratzinger was the prefect. And they issued an authoritative opinion that to disagree with the Pope on the matter of the ethics of the death penalty was not something that would bar one from Holy Communion. So it's not a matter of heresy or dogma, right?
Yeah. Okay.
The plot thickens, okay? There is a teaching about the lay Catholics, or actually all Catholics, responsibility towards non-infallible papal teaching, right? Something's not proclaimed as a dogma. What is the attitude of the lay faithful? And this is, I'm simplifying, but there is a category called religious submission of mind and will. And that's not the same thing as the assent of divine and supernatural faith. Divine and supernatural faith is, sometimes you see the bumper sticker, God said it, I believe it, that settles it, right?
Yep.
That's divine and supernatural faith, right? Religious submission of mind and will is not the same thing, right? It's more like acknowledgement that the Pope is the official spokesperson for the Church. He sets policy. He teaches dogma. You don't. And even if you disagree with something the Pope says, you have a moral obligation to take it seriously, to take it to heart, to consider it, to mull over it, and certainly not to take an obnoxiously contrary position in a very public sphere, right? I mean, like, he's the spokesperson for the Church. He lays out the way the thing goes, not you, right? You can maintain private doubts about it, but you're not going to do that in a kind of grossly obstinate and public way. And so you can, personally, right, I understand these nuances, I think, and I've come to appreciate the Pope's point of view for this reason, right? Though I recognize that there is a longstanding tradition of allowing the death penalty and sometimes even calling for it under Catholic moral thought, I do think that there's a shift in the culture, the technology, the means of social communication that changes the moral context. I mean, John Paul's argument makes sense to me, and I'll put it this way. Imagine, if you can, that the Pope came out and said, yay, death penalty. Go, death penalty. Let's have more death penalty. I'm all for the death penalty. Imagine that were the Pope's position. Then ask yourself this question: who would benefit? And instantly, it's not hard to come up with the answer. The most unjust, tyrannical regimes in the world, who have the least respect for human dignity, would jump on that bandwagon with both feet, and they'd be like, we've hated the Pope all these years, but he's our man now, And I don't think that's any place that the Pope wants to put the Church in ethical dialogue with the nations.
Sure. Stephen, thanks so much for your question via YouTube. And certainly a lot of Catholics do struggle with this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So there you go. And in a moment, we're going to talk with Steve in Louisville, also Karen in San Antonio. A couple lines open for you. Better grab one now because they may go quickly. 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Do stay with us. Glad you're with us for a Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call at 833 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Or if you wish, text the letters EWTN to 58177. Hey, congratulations to another EWTN radio partner, the great Divine Mercy Radio, with two stations serving Raleigh and Durham, North Carolina, celebrating 10 years with us. Congratulations to Melissa Savage and her great team there at Divine Mercy Radio from your friends here at EWTN. All right, back to the phones now for Steve in Louisville, listening on our longtime partner, the great Holy Family Radio. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, I am a practicing Catholic, and I am just about animals. I talked to a priest one time in confession, and I said, you know, do animals go to heaven? And they said, if that's what it takes to make you happy, then your pet or whatever will be in heaven. And I'm like, well, I don't necessarily, not for my sake, do I need them to be in heaven for me to be happy, because I will be with God, so I will definitely be happy. But I'm just for their sake. I mean, I just think these animals make such a sacrifice. You know, they give us food, you know, and plus they give us a lot of love. And I just hear a lot of the Protestants always talking about, oh, yeah, animals go to heaven. You've heard of the rainbow gate or something to that effect. I can't remember what it was, but the Catholic, I just never hear us talk about it very much, and I think that's a very important issue to a lot of people.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, of course, the Catholic teaching on the nature of the human person is that humans are unique in having immaterial and therefore immortal souls. Animals don't have that. But there is a caveat. So, you know, the whole idea of going to heaven when you die, and that's kind of colloquial language, but doesn't really capture the fullness of the Catholic vision of the next life, because Catholics look forward not so much to, quote, going to heaven when I die, end quote, as to the resurrection of the dead and the return of Christ at the end of time. I mean, the story doesn't end until Christ comes back. And sacred scripture teaches that when Christ returns, not only will we be raised from the dead, but there'll be a renewal of the created order. St. Paul says that creation itself groans longing for the sons of God, that is to say, those who die in grace, to be revealed. And to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense to renew the created order and then depopulate it of everybody except humans. I mean, it'd be kind of a boring recreated heavens and the earth if it was like, you know, suddenly everything becomes... well, you know, concrete or even shimmering gold if there's not a single butterfly to, you know, reflect that glory. So I think it's not unreasonable to imagine that there might be animal life in the renewed heavens and the earth. Now, let's hold that out as an intellectual possibility. What does that mean about the intermediate state, right? Because Catholic Church also teaches as you're awaiting the resurrection from the dead, you're not just unconscious that you are either experiencing the beatific vision, purgatory, or hell, right? And that's, of course, in a disembodied state. And you know, St. Paul talks about this state when he says that when you're unclothed, and here he means without the body, you long to be clothed, that is, to get your body back, right? Now, animals clearly can't participate in that intermediate state because lacking immortal souls, lacking immaterial souls, there's nothing of the animal that could have that experience, right? Because they're entirely material. Their souls are entirely material. So with the dissolution of the matter, there's nothing left to bear consciousness, right? Doesn't mean that there can't be animals in the next life. Now, you know, will a dog that looks exactly like my dog Harry, right, my golden retriever, you know, hypothetically, even down to the, you know, to each individual, hair follicle, right, and have the very same personality and, you know, chase after balls with the same alacrity and all of that, and maybe even answer to the same name, would it in fact be the same dog if it didn't have an immortal soul to bear that continuity of personality from one instantiation to the next? Well, that's a philosophical question that I don't know. Maybe I'll leave to Star Trek. But but I don't think it's impossible to imagine that you could have some kind of animal life in the resurrection. And again, you won't lose your memories of your animal friends, and in fact, those will be transformed in the light of God's glory and justice.
Any thoughts about why Protestants may discuss all this a little more?
Well, I don't know that they maybe they do discuss it, but and again, that's a generalization. And
yeah,
so
sure.
I know I grew up in the Protestant church, and I was told generally was a kid in the Protestant church, animals probably don't make it to heaven, but, you know, quote, they'll be there if you need them, end quote. And I think that was just something that they said to me as a child to comfort me when I lost my first Labrador Retriever at age 12 and was nearly devastated by that. But if it is in fact true, and I don't want to stretch and say that I know that to be empirically the fact that Protestants are more voluble in their discussions of animal life and the next life, you know, I don't know that, to me, I mean, and I don't want to be too critical, but there's a lot of sentimentality in my judgment that goes into the construction of popular Protestant theology. And so that may have an effect. Now, to be fair, I've met my share of sentimental Catholics, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who invent their own ideas as well. But, you know, the nice thing is, as Catholics, we have the magisterium to come in and say, okay, this is dogma, this is not.
Right.
Right. And they like that in Protestantism. So sometimes maybe sentiment can catch hold and run away with them, and there's nobody to say stop.
Steve, thanks so much for your call from Louisville. Let's go to Houston now and talk with Sam, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Sam, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, quick question. A few years ago, a major political figure or figures gave the cardinal or the bishop, if you believe in the north, for the northern part of the U.S., even though the cardinal or bishop knew the politician, say, was pro-abortion, he granted that politician communion. So what does Rome say about that, the Pope?
Not much. Not much, honestly. I mean, and that is to say that the Pope doesn't generally intervene and rebuke bishops about their individual decisions to grant or withhold communion from particular people, right? That's not generally the kind of thing that Rome would intervene about. I mean, Rome is pretty clear that abortion is a grave evil.
Yes.
Right? And the church is pretty clear that there are grave evils that are public scandals that would be occasions for barring some individual from communion if granting them communion would give the impression that the church is essentially approving or sweeping under the rug some grave evils. I mean, there is a provision in the church for barring people from communion for doing gravely evil things in the public sphere, right? You know, the judgment about why would some particular bishop make that call or not make that call is really beyond the scope of this show because I don't know those bishops personally.
Sure. Appreciate your call from Houston. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We can squeeze in a few more phone calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Rose watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Rose says, marriage should be unitive and procreative. Is it okay in old age?
It is okay in old age. And the key distinction here is that when you enter into marriage, you enter into the kind of relationship that would naturally be fulfilled in the bearing of children if God sees fit to grant you such children. No one knows when they get married if they will have kids.
True.
You could be 20 years old and not know if you'll have kids. I mean, a lot of 20-year-olds get married thinking they're going to have kids and find out nature doesn't cooperate. They don't have kids. But they enter into the union open to the idea. Open
sure.
to the idea, and they behave in such a way, if you follow me, that that openness is given some, you know, concrete expression, right? Well, whatever age you enter into marriage, you do the same thing. You enter in with an openness to life if God sees fit to grant you that life, and it's up to the divine providence to decide whether or not to grant it. You know, Abraham and Sarah are some pretty old folks.
Yep.
They said, life, not going to happen. It happened, right?
Yeah.
So that's the answer.
Rose, thanks so much for checking in via YouTube this afternoon. If you're new to EWTN, may I recommend one of our wonderful morning programs? It's the Sunrise Morning Show, a great way to start off your day with Anna Mitchell and Matt Swaim tomorrow morning and every weekday at 6 a.m. Eastern on EWTN. They start your day with news, interviews with a Catholic perspective, always a fascinating program, and they do keep it moving because We all have to get on with our day. So check it out tomorrow morning and every weekday, 6 a.m. Eastern, the Sunrise Morning Show on EWTN Radio. Gerard asks a very interesting question on YouTube, a rather thoughtful question. He wants to know, what is a good way to treat religious trauma?
Yeah, that is a really good question. So I am not a therapist, nor the son of one. And so, you know, I want to be very cautious about talking about how to treat trauma, okay?
Sure.
So let me begin by saying that there are accepted evidence-based modalities for the treatment of trauma, and I imagine that some of those same techniques are applicable regardless of the source of the trauma, okay?
Okay.
Whether that trauma be from religious abuse or some other kind of abuse. And so my first piece of advice would be find a trauma specialist and talk to them, right? I myself feel like I was a victim of some degree of religious trauma from my fundamentalist upbringing. And, off topic, but I still, for about 20 years after I finished my doctoral dissertation, I would wake up in the middle of the night with my heart pounding and sweat pouring from my forehead with every graduate student's fear, which was, oh my gosh, I didn't finish my dissertation. You know, and the thought of going back and finishing it was just unthinkable to me.
Ugh.
And then I'd get up and, you know, kind of shake the sleep out of my eyes and be like, okay, it was just a nightmare. It was just a nightmare. There it is. There's the degree hanging on the wall, you know. But in a similar fashion, you know, I still sometimes have these moments where, you know, I kind of lapse into a sort of, macabre reverie and recall moments from my past when something, you know, fairly traumatic would happen in the religious domain. And in a sense, my entire life has been, religiously, has been sort of an attempt to escape from that, right? And that one of the reasons that I embraced Catholicism was that I was so enamored of the idea of a religion grounded in a realist moral and epistemological framework. What do I mean by that? Well, the Catholic Church has always said that we have the capacity to know reality, maybe not completely, but adequately, and that our moral judgments are grounded in a rational assessment of the human person, right? Moral and epistemological realism. So, you know, if I come to find from rational analysis that something is good for a person or something is bad for a person, I can reasonably conclude that that is moral or immoral in consequence. Similarly, if I find through empirical study or experience that there's some fact about reality, well, then that's true whether or not my religion wants it to be true.
Sure,
and
sure.
A good example would be I was raised in a you know, 7-day creation, 10,000-year-old young earth kind of fundamentalism. And when those folks encountered evidence from geology or biology or anthropology that ran up against their convictions, their response was to say, well, so much the worse for biology and geology and anthropology,
ooh,
right? And so it forced the child like me into a position of being at odds with culture, at odds with reality, at odds with reason, and ultimately at odds with myself, with my most authentic being, right? Also, similarly, when Calvinism taught me that God created the vast majority of the world expressly for the purpose of damning them eternally to hell and gave them no choice in the matter, that struck me as manifestly unjust, traumatically so.
Yeah.
And the answer I got was, well, you know, your ways are not God's ways, you know, shut up and obey, essentially, right? And when I became Catholic, I encountered a mode of religious being that said no to both of those traumatic responses. It said, no, if reality shows you something that's true, it's true! And if you have to go back and revise some of your religious presuppositions to accommodate this new true information,
yeah,
truth wins out. That Catholicism is always on the side of truth. It's never going to put itself against truth, right? And the same thing goes in the moral domain. If something strikes me intuitively as being profoundly unethical or unjust, well, I'm not going to predicate that of God. And this, I found this in the Fathers. You know, Gregory of Nyssa would read passages of the Old Testament and say, you know, if I take this literally, it's unworthy of God. Guess what I'm not going to do? Take it literally,
yeah,
right? And I went, you can do this? Like, you can actually think this way and be a Christian? And then I read Augustine, and I found out that, you know, for Augustine, the word that became flesh, right, of course, is the same word that that gives light to every man, right? And that Justin Martyr thought that meant that our rational capacities themselves were a reflection of the divine logos, and that I could know Christ by knowing the rational content of my own mind. And I said, man, this stuff is better than Wheaties.
It is so freeing.
You know, and it was tremendous. It was like, my soul was given wings, and it was so liberating, right? And so I've spent my whole life trying to immerse myself, my whole adult life, my whole Catholic life, trying to fully assimilate the implications of this profoundly liberating Catholic view of reality. And I have to catch myself sometimes with fundamentalist instincts that kind of awaken that traumatic response. And then it's kind of like seeing the dissertation on my wall and going, okay, I really did finish. I slap myself and go, I'm really Catholic. I don't have to do that anymore.
Wonderful. Appreciate that. Gerard, thank you so much for your question via YouTube. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Susan's watching us on YouTube as well. Susan says, do you have any advice, Dr. Anders, on how to approach the confessional with less anxiety? I know many Catholics who have a fear of it.
Yeah, I do. Thanks very much. I appreciate the asking. The first thing to do is to get very clear in your own mind what your obligations towards the confessional are, okay?
Okay.
And so first of all, the Church teaches your obligation is to confess your known mortal sins, that is, those that you know about, those that you remember, mortal, meaning not venial, all right, your known mortal sins, in kind and number. That is, you don't have to give your whole intellectual or spiritual autobiography.
No.
You just, I committed murder and committed this and committed that this many times, right? In kind and number, once a year. That's what the Church requires. Kind and number, mortal sins, once a year. All right? Now, many pious Catholics, the popes included, do a lot more than that. But that's the bare minimum, okay? And so if you have any other conception in your mind about what you, quote, have to confess, end quote, then already you're operating under a delusion, right? And so get clear. Now, for many people, the challenge comes in with, well, Anders, how do I know if it's a mortal sin? And if you're scrupulous, watch out, right? Because then to the scrupulous person, every peccadillo seems like a mortal sin, right? And you might have a different kind of anxiety, which is that you go to the confessional and you say, well, Father, I did this thing. And the priest, kind of almost stifles a little chuckle. And it's like, that is totally not a sin. Do not confess it again. Then the anxiety is, well, but if I don't confess it, I won't be absolved and I'll go to hell.
Mm.
Because you're not willing to surrender your own judgment.
Even
though the priest has said, don't confess it again. Yeah. You're not willing to surrender your own judgment because that constant tendency to be self-critical gives you a false sense of security. Like, this is what the obsessive person who's terribly afraid of germs does, right? They won't even leave their house for fear of germs. And, they don't realize it would be better to get sick than to destroy your life out of fear of germs, right? And so the scrupulous person feels like, well, if I don't confess absolutely everything that enters my head, then I'll go to hell, right? And so what they do is they consign themselves to a living hell.
Yeah.
They consign themselves to a living hell. That's a different kind of scrupulosity. So a different kind of anxiety about the confessional.
Yeah.
So what do you do in these two instances? Get really clear, right? If you're scrupulous, you cannot get clear on the distinction between a mortal and venial sin. I've become persuaded of this, having known too many scrupulous people. They can't. They just can't do it. They cannot help themselves. So what they have to do is they have to submit their judgment to somebody else. You've got to find a priest who knows what scrupulosity is and how to treat it. He understands the distinction, and he says, you can confess this often, these things, and don't ever confess that other thing again. And then you have to do what feels wrong and obey him. And that's the thing with any obsession, the only way you can get over it is to, quote, do what feels wrong.
And you need to stick with that confessor.
And you need to stick with that guy. And I know a case of somebody who did that. Priest said, do not confess this thing again. So they went and found another confessor so they could keep on confessing it, okay? So you just can't do that.
Now, no.
What if it's not scrupulosity? What if that's not your problem? What if it's just the fact of bearing your soul to another human being? All right? Here's what I would do if I were you. First of all, remember, kind and number, kind and number, kind and number, mortal sins, all right? And then And then think about making yourself go more often than you need to. Because, again, the way to get over any kind of compulsion or inhibition is just expose yourself to the thing that causes you discomfort until it doesn't cause you discomfort.
Sure.
If you're scrupulous, go less often, say fewer things. If that's not your problem, maybe take the opposite approach, you know, depending on what's holding you back.
And Susan, thanks so much for checking in via YouTube. We have this this question here from Karen in San Antonio. She called in, couldn't stay on the line, but she says, my son, who is in his late 20s, doesn't like the things that the Pope or the Archbishop does. He was especially perturbed by the blessing of the ice cube. I had to look that one up. Never heard of it. How do I convince him the church is about God, not the bishops, and that he should come back to Mass?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, well, I mean, the issue of Catholic hierarchs scandalizing the faithful is as old as the church.
Yeah.
And, of course, St. Peter did it. And I have often thought, I mean, imagine Peter in Antioch. Peter is in Antioch. And he's eating pepperoni with the Gentile Christians. And they're like, we get to hang out with Peter. This is great stuff. And then one day, in comes this group from Jerusalem representing James. And Peter sees them coming, and he knows what they're about. And you know what he does? He says, no more pepperoni with the Gentiles. And he pulls back, and he isolates himself and only eats kosher with the Jews. How do you think those Gentiles in Antioch felt? They felt like trash. How could they not? They felt like trash. So Paul shows up, and he says, Peter. You idiot! You just scandalized all the Gentile Christians. And you know that you're wrong, and you did this because you're embarrassed to stand up to James's people. I mean, that's all it is. You're just embarrassed to stand up to James's people because you know they don't take the same position. Shame on you. And you can see Peter going, oh, you know, yeah. meep. And hopefully, you know, he got it straight and died in Rome, right?
Yes.
But he scandalized them, right, because of something he did publicly. And popes and bishops and priests and lay people have been doing this forever, right? And it's a false view of the church if you think the point of the church is to get you into communion with the Pope. The point of communion with the Pope is to keep you in communion with the universal church, which is to get you into communion with Christ.
Sure.
Right? The Pope is the means, not the end. Christ is the end, right? And you know, nobody understood this better than Francis of Assisi. You know, Francis came along at a time when the local clergy in Assisi was, you know, nothing to write home about, to say the least. And you know, things in Rome had gotten pretty wild, too. And he responded to that by saying, okay, popes and the bishops are going to live immoral lives and be lax in their personal discipline. Well, then I'm going to double down on not doing that. And so, you know, if he thought they were bad examples, his response was to be a good example. And no one was ever more Christ-intoxicated than Francis of Assisi. Absolutely. Nobody on the planet ever did more to try to give themselves entirely to the imitation of Christ and his character and to live Christ's life after him, to walk in Christ's steps after him, to think Christ's thoughts after him more than Francis of Assisi. That was his response to church corruption, to not be corrupt, right?
Right.
All day long, right? And you know, the hierarchy... you know, St. Augustine once said that the accoutrements of Catholic life, scripture, tradition, liturgy, hierarchy, are like a road or a chariot. The means is the point of them is to get you to the end. They're means to an end, get you to the end of the road. They're not the means, and they're not the end itself, right? And you have to remember that, right? The end is charity. And so, you know, you might live in a part of the country where the roads are pristine and well kept, and you're driving down the road and think, it's a pretty road. I like this road, you know. You might live in a part of the country where the bridges are falling apart, there's potholes everywhere, and you're like, man, I can't wait to get off this road, right? I think that's a good analogy. You might be in a diocese where the bishop is all pristine and lovely and beautiful, and what a great bishop I have, and how happy I am that he's my bishop, right? You may be in a diocese where you think, I can't wait to get off this bishop, right? You know? And there have been saints that have actually prayed this, right? They had, their attitude towards the Pope was... God, can you hurry on up and get us a new one? Oh, that's all Cardinal Newman was, right, with respect to to Pope Pius IX. Newman was no fan of Pope Pius at all. And he used to pray, hurry on up, God, we need to get to Pope Pius X. But he never thought about leaving the church.
Of course.
This is all about Jesus.
Absolutely. Karen, we hope that is helpful for you. Thanks for checking in from San Antonio. Fast-moving hour today. Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Tom.
Don't forget, we do it Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN Radio. Check out the podcast 24/7 by going to EWTN's Podcast Central. It's available right now and in the middle of the night, whenever you want to check it out. EWTN.com/podcasts. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Be sure to stick around. We have Open Line Tuesday with Father Wade Menezes coming up next on most of these stations. Until tomorrow, have a beautiful day. God bless.